Okay, good morning. So today's Monday, August 25th, our second week, and some people are looking at Blackboard and still kind of finding their way around. So don't forget, you got the syllabus on Blackboard, you've got the pre-lecture reading assignment, and you have the answer keys to the pre-lecture reading assignment, but you should only have for the first two because I want you to do the reading assignment before I tell you what the answers are. They're really, I think, low-level questions, but it helps you get involved with the chapter a little bit so that you can understand what's happening in lecture. So let's see, what else is on Blackboard? There's the study guide, and then there are exam figures. So on the study guide, it will tell you what exam figures I might photocopy and put on the test, and that's just rote memorization. You should get 100% on that part of the test, right? So even if you have to label each one of those figures 10 times, it's worth it because you'll get 100% on that part of the test. And that's usually maybe about 30%, maybe 35%, and that can certainly make a big difference in grade for some people, right? So just make sure you can get 100% on that part of the test. So where are some of these things? Well, let's see, course information, you have things like the syllabus, that weekly study plan, and you all should show that weekly study plan to your lab instructor this week and show them how you're doing on it, okay, because that will help you get a good grade in the class. Here's the lecture exam study guide. So, for instance, here's study guide for exam number one with figures. So the figures that are on your list, I erased all of the labels off so you can print them out just like how it's going to be on the test. You can practice labeling. This one right here is just a short form. This doesn't have exam figures, but it has everything else, all the chapters and review questions and things like that. Notice that the file, these are both, what, Microsoft Word documents? And the one with exam files is over 4 megabytes, but the study guide without figures is what, a real dinky 26 kilobytes. That's really small. So depending on which one you need, you can download. Where are we? We're in course information. What's under course documents? Oh, the lecture slides. And I think this is just the same file right here. And also for the first test, and maybe for the first practicum, you want to look at this video here that I put on there for you. It just goes over naming the parts of a microscope, maybe a little bit about what some of the functions are. All right, and assignments. Here are all of the assignments that you have to do for the semester, or you should do. It's not going to contribute to your grade, except it is kind of magical because if you do them before the lecture, it will help you out in lecture. And if you do well and understand what's going on in lecture, then it's going to translate to how well you do on the test. So it's really helpful for you to do these pre-lecture reading assignments. And if you go back to assignments, here are answer keys. Good, for the first two, right, because we're still covering cells today. So sometime before Wednesday, you probably want to do the pre-lecture reading assignment for the next chapter, which is tissues, which is going to be on your practicum coming up next week. Yeah. Yeah? Okay. I can understand because the mitochondria kind of looks rod-shaped a little bit, but you know what? More of a classical description of a mitochondria is people like to say they're bean-shaped. So maybe they have a little bit of curvature to them. They're not quite like a tube. But the centrioles or centrosomes are really more tubular in nature because their subcomponents really are tubular kinds of proteins. All right, so and a mitochondria can have more of a diffuse shape to it. It can have a little bend to it. It can have an indentation. So for rod-shaped, I would say centrioles or centrosome complex. And for mitochondria, some other more diffuse kind of shape. And that's strictly a rod. Could be bean, could have a little curve, could be like a sickle or something without the pointed ends. Yeah.
Diagram of the things that you label, the blank.
Exam figures.
Yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't match for the cells you're writing in the book and on the Blackboard. They're like different editions or something.
Oh, I'll have to go back and double check. I'll forget. So if you can send me an email and remind me, that would be great. Okay. But the figures that are in your book are the ones that show the stages of mitosis Or if you have your book, let's look it over and let's just see, because some of those figures have a lot of different parts to it, like A, B, C, D, E, F, G. But if the number's wrong, then yeah, that's really a mistake. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Oh, for open lab. There's another open lab with Dr. Sanchez. And this is on Friday, 4:30, I think, until 5. It might be 5:30, I'm not sure. But it's not in anatomy lab. You know, there are two rooms that we're using for anatomy lab. One is kind of in the corner and the other is down by the elevator a little bit. He's going to be in the one down by the elevator, and I don't know what room number that is. I don't know the room number.
Is that every Friday?
That's every Friday, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, you know, maybe I'll try and send an email out to everybody with those hours for lab. Okay, so does anybody have any questions over what we were talking about last time? Organelles. Why do cells have organelles? Because organelles have what? A special job, and that job might interfere with other special jobs that are going on inside the cell. So organelles are there so that the cell can do all these little special jobs without interference with each other. So what's a special job that mitochondria does? Makes ATP. What's a special job that Golgi body does? Modification and packaging. And smooth endoplasmic reticulum, what's its job? Lipid synthesis. So those you should just really have on the tip of your tongue so that when you take the test, you answer those questions real quick and then you have an hour just to kick back and relax, right? Or read some other questions that might be a little bit more difficult. All right, so, also I'll probably get the lectures on the internet real soon. They're almost ready to go on the internet if you want to look at some of those lectures again, or listen to them. Okay, so I think we're done with organelles, unless somebody's got a question about a specific kind of organelle. Make sure you know the difference between condensed chromatin and extended chromatin. For instance, which kind of chromatin is being used, but the trade-off is that when it's being used, it can be damaged. It can be lost. What kind of chromatin is that? Extended chromatin. That's right. And what kind of chromatin is in safe storage? It can't be used, but at least it's safe. It can't be destroyed very easily. Condensed chromatin, and condensed chromatin is what makes chromosomes. You can actually see those with a light microscope, and maybe the first week or this week in lab, you'll see some different stages of mitosis. You'll be able to see chromosomes underneath the light microscope. Okay, so we learned a lot about the plasma membrane last time, and that there are all kinds of proteins in the membrane that can act as antigens, receptors, enzymes, and also special passageways for material in and out of the cell. So we would call those channels. And so let's talk about how things can move across the plasma membrane. So good things, bad things, and this is just some physical chemistry for you. This is how everything in the universe operates by these principles. So there are two general kinds of processes by which things can move across the membrane. The first one is passive transport, and the other one is active transport. Passive is like watching TV. Okay, passive transport doesn't require any energy. It's just something that happens automatically, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. So when we say energy, what do we really mean in terms of a molecule inside your cell? ATP. That's right. So a passive process does not require what? ATP, right? Or energy. An active process, on the other hand, is a process that does require energy, or a better way of saying it, does require, somebody said over here, does require ATP in order for that to happen. Okay. So the way that we understand these particular processes is, for instance, if this thing right here is the cell membrane, and we're going to look at the concentration of some kind of particle in solution. We call that a solute. Like glucose, for instance. Every dot over here represents a molecule of glucose. All right, so what's the concentration of glucose inside the cell compared to outside the cell, as I drew it on the board right here? What's the concentration look like? Oh, look, I goofed. Now what's the concentration? Okay, it's equal. All right, so it's equal. So that's what we mean by concentration. Just the number of particles on one side of the membrane compared to the other. All right, now if it's like this, which concentration is higher? Outside, there's more particles on the outside, right? Okay. So that's what we mean by concentration difference, and there's also a concentration gradient. A concentration gradient means that there just is a difference in solutes or particles across the membrane. And the way that things work, in a passive process, things will always go from a high concentration to a low concentration. That's going to be a passive process. It doesn't require energy to do that. Like if I have this marker right here, and I put it on this podium. If I put it over here, is it going to roll? No. If I put it over here, is it going to roll? Yeah, because things naturally want to go from what? High to low. The same thing for transport processes across the membrane. Molecules will move from high concentration to low concentration without energy expenditure. Anybody have a question on that? I usually have a really long discussion on this. But does everybody kind of see what I'm talking about here? Okay. All right. If we have this marker down here at a low position and we want it to go to a higher position, same thing for concentration, great for concentration. If this was low here and high here, how can we get this molecule to go to a higher concentration? We have to do what? We got to push it up. That's going to require energy, and in terms of the cell, that would be ATP to do that. Okay. So, there are two kinds. Let's see if my marker works way over here. So there are two kinds of passive properties that you have to be familiar with. All right, the first one is called diffusion, and the second one is osmosis. So let's talk about diffusion first. Okay, diffusion is the movement of any molecule down its concentration gradient. And what does that mean? Always from high to low, not requiring any energy. So if I have a perfume bottle right here and I open it up, that perfume is going to evaporate into the air, and it's not going to stay right here because by just the natural processes of the universe, that perfume is going to move from high concentration to low concentration. And where is low concentration going to be? Way in the back of the room, even the corners of the room over here. And so that perfume molecule is going to diffuse, and people in the front row are going to smell it first, and then the second row and third row. And even though there's no fan in the room moving that perfume molecule around, it's going to diffuse. Always from what kind of concentration? High to low concentration. So that's what we just called diffusion. So diffusion happens in air. Diffusion happens in a solution, in a water solution. Diffusion doesn't happen in something like a solid because molecules can't move around in a solid, but in gases and liquids, molecules can diffuse around very easily. So diffusion is any kind of molecule that goes from a high concentration to low concentration. That's diffusion. And what can you tell me about the energy requirements for that happening? None. It just automatically happens. And our bodies rely on that process all the time for moving molecules around. Okay, so that's diffusion. Passive, from high concentration to low concentration. Now, there's a special kind of diffusion. We call this osmosis. So the first thing is that it is diffusion. So there are three criteria for being osmosis. It's diffusion. That's kind of a loaded term, because what does diffusion mean? What does diffusion mean? High to low? What about energy? No energy. So you got to know what diffusion means to be able to answer this question. Right? Number one. And number two, I said for diffusion, it could be a perfume molecule in this room. Or it could be a glucose, like this glucose molecule. Which way is glucose going to want to go across this partition right here? It's going to want to go in this direction, right? From high to low. Okay, so diffusion could be any molecule moving from high concentration to low. But for osmosis right here, there's only one molecule that we're interested in, and that is the water molecule. And can I write it like that? H2O. Okay, that's just the chemical formula for water. So perfume can't osmose, glucose can't osmose. So if I ask you a question on a test, which of the below molecules could be osmosing? A, glucose, B, water, C, lipid, D, blah, 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 and E, iron. Which one are you going to say?
Water.
Only water, because that's what osmosis means. Okay, and number three, the third criteria for osmosis is that there has to be a membrane involved. Doesn't have to be a living membrane, but there has to be some kind of membrane. All right, so across a membrane. And not just any kind of membrane, okay, but it's got to be a selectively permeable membrane. So what does selectively permeable mean? Yeah, it allows certain molecules to go through, but not everything. All right, so what did we say about this particle right here? Well, let's make it water. Let's make black water, okay? And then let's make this blue one here, glucose. And if glucose can go across this membrane right here, and water can go across this membrane, so far, is this a selectively permeable membrane? No. So is water osmosing? No, because it's not a selectively permeable membrane. But, for instance, if we have glucose coming to the membrane and then getting bonked away because it can't get through, is that a selectively permeable membrane? Yeah. And would this be an example of osmosis? Yeah, it's an example of diffusion as well, but it's also a good example of osmosis. Because why? This molecule here is diffusing, going from high to low, not requiring any energy. It's got a selectively permeable membrane, and water, of course, is water. Okay. So, yeah.
So it's only osmosis.
That's right.
And only water and nothing else?
It has to be able to exclude something. Maybe it will exclude some other things besides water, but it's got to be able to exclude something. Okay, so other things can go through, but it's got to be able to reject something. Yeah. Exactly the same. So selectively permeable and semi-permeable membrane are exactly the same. Some things go through, but not others. Yeah. Nope. Passive only means going from high concentration to low and requiring what kind of energy? No energy. So a good example of diffusion of something going from inside the cell to the outside, still going from high concentration inside the cell to low concentration outside, would be a waste product that all of our cells make, and that is carbon dioxide. So the way that carbon dioxide leaves our body is by diffusion, going from high concentration in the cell, and it eventually is going to end up in the air because the concentration of CO2 in the air is almost zero. So carbon dioxide leaves our body very quickly, very readily, because the concentration of carbon dioxide is almost zero. It's like 0.03%. So that's pretty small, right? That's really, really small concentration. Okay, I want to just tell you about another definition, and that is, what the heck is a solution? a solution of something. It's equal to two things. Anybody got a guess what are the components of a solution? Yeah.
A solvent and a solute.
Yeah, there's the liquid part, which is the solvent, and there's the junk that's dissolved in the solvent. We call those solutes. Right? So a solution is solvent plus solute. So in our bodies, what's the solvent? And indeed, it's true of maybe of all biological systems that we know of. The solvent is H2O. And what's dissolved in our bodies? What's the solute? Yeah, like for instance, a lot of good examples. Glucose, salt, various proteins are in there. Gases like oxygen, CO2. Okay, so gases can dissolve in liquids as well. And all these things will diffuse around according to their concentration gradient. Okay, so in this definition of osmosis, I kind of made it applicable to a biological system, and some of you might have a background maybe in chemistry or something. So number two right here, I wrote down water, but what's a better general term for what belongs here? Okay, for osmosis, doesn't necessarily have to be water. It could be what? The solvent. Maybe you're dealing with organic chemistry with a different kind of solvent. Okay, so in this thing right here, solvent. But in all biological systems, what's the solvent that all of our stuff is dissolved in? Water. So it's a perfect definition for everything that we're going to be concerned about in this class. Okay. All right, but if you take some advanced class later and you're talking about some other kind of solvent, other solvents can osmose, but these other two criteria are still important for osmosis, even though it's a different solvent. What would still be some important criteria that another solvent has to abide by in order for it to be osmosis? What are the other two criteria? There has to be a selectively permeable membrane, number one, and number two, it still has to be diffusion, which is passive. Okay, so those are some passive processes. Active transport, on the other hand, requires energy, or you could say ATP. And the way that energy and ATP is used is that ATP is broken down into two other molecules. So when the energy in ATP is used, ATP gets converted to adenosine diphosphate. We call that ADP. And what's left over is just a simple phosphate, inorganic phosphate. That's why I had that little sub-I. That little sub-I stands for inorganic phosphate. And the other thing that is given up during that reaction is energy. And that energy can be used for anything, but we're talking about transport, and in particular, active transport in this particular process. So what does ATP sort of look like? Well, there is a big molecule that I'm not going to draw out, but it's adenosine. All right, and adenosine triphosphate is going to look something like this. All right. I don't think you need to be able to draw this, but what I want you to actually to see is, all right, this P right here stands for a phosphate element. So on adenosine, how many phosphate elements are there? You see three. One, two, three. So that would be what? ATP, tri, because tri stands for the three phosphates. So this would be a good example of ATP. And ADP, on the other hand, is going to be what? Adenosine, the exact same molecule right here, except what? Yeah. Oh, sorry, I forgot a little O right there. Like that. It's going to have two phosphates on it. And over here, there's going to be another molecule. So I put a little plus sign. That means it's going to be floating around all by itself. And what is that going to be? That's going to be the phosphate which looks like that. So that phosphate is now floating around the cell. Okay. So this is just what we call inorganic phosphate. And I abbreviate that in the notes, what? P sub I. And I'd like to use that because this is just too big of a thing to draw out every time. Okay. Now, here's a good kind of synthesis kind of question. With this O plus, when ATP goes to ADP plus inorganic phosphate, what else are we left with? There's something else here. Energy. Right. We have energy to do work in our bodies. Okay. And this equation also describes something else that's very important. But it doesn't go in this direction. It goes in the reverse direction. What organelle makes this reaction go in the reverse direction? This is good kind of synthesis question. Just as a matter of fact, to see if you get a picture of that organelle in your mind. There's an organelle that works the reverse of this chemical equation right here. And somebody said it. That is the mitochondria, because the mitochondria makes ATP. So mitochondria can rejuvenate this ATP. It can take ADP from the cell and inorganic phosphate as long as it has what? Energy. And the way that it gets that energy is that mitochondria need oxygen to do their job too in order to make ATP. So that kind of explains something else that we do all the time. What are we doing all the time? We're breathing to get oxygen so that those mitochondria can make ATP for us. So that's the point of that. And if we can't breathe, then what do we run out of? What molecule do we run out of? If we can't breathe, we don't have oxygen inside our bodies. Mitochondria can't do their job. We run out of ATP. We run out of energy. We run out of ATP. And I guess I'd like to tell you just a little something interesting. How much ATP do we need every day? Probably a lot, do you think, or just a fair amount? Probably a lot. Okay, so to give you a feel as to how much ATP we need, for instance, if somebody has a heart attack and their heart stops beating, and then the blood is not delivering oxygen to the brain, it just stops all automatically like that. But your brain is still alive. In order to stay alive, what does it need? ATP. So even though your heart is stopped, your brain still needs ATP. Your brain's alive. It's using up ATP to maintain consciousness. So when your heart stops, how long can your brain go? How long can your brain maintain consciousness without those mitochondria being able to make ATP? Okay. You lose consciousness in 3 to 4 seconds. Yeah, 3 to 4 seconds. So after a couple seconds, your brain runs out of so much ATP, you lose consciousness. So that's how much ATP you need. And then, if your circulation isn't reestablished, when does your brain die? And that means you can't be resuscitated. When something's dead, you can't bring it back to life, except in movies or something like that, right? So when does your brain actually die? When can't you be revived again? 3 seconds, you're unconscious. After what period of time is your brain dead, or parts of your brain dead? And it's really the same kind of figure, except it's not seconds, it's in minutes, 3 to 4 minutes. So that's how much ATP your brain needs, because it's very active all the time. And it controls every bodily function. And there's one other thing that it likes to do more than anything else besides controlling your body. It actually likes to learn things, believe it or not. That's what brains really are designed to do, is to learn things. That might not feel like it all the time, but that's really what it likes to do. Or even when you're watching TV, your brain is learning, being stimulated by things. Okay. And another way to think about ATP is how much ATP your body needs. And a day to stay alive. So if you think of a whole day, we can give you how much in terms of weight, how much ATP is required. So a normal everyday person, probably a male, the textbook figure is about 80 kilograms, something like that. Maybe 70 kilograms, probably 70 would be more likely. 70 kilograms. And If you were to measure all the ATP that your body went through every day, converting it into ADP and energy, it would be 40 kilograms of ATP. So you could say about half your body weight you need in order to stay alive in terms of ATP. You're not carrying that around with you at any one particular time. You don't have like a luggage of ATP. Okay, but why is that? Because you have mitochondria that as soon as ATP is made, it's converted back to ATP. So it's always being remade for you. Okay, so that's some interesting things about ATP. Okay, so let's take a look now at some active processes. Now, what are some nice things about active processes? What can they do for you? Can remove waste from your body. Let's go back to this diagram right here. I'll try to erase all this stuff. Okay, so this is inside the cell. Here's outside the cell. And we've got some glucose outside the cell. So we got some water inside. And cells need glucose because that's how mitochondria make ATP. They break glucose down and they make ATP in the process of doing that. Okay, so where is the highest concentration of glucose? Inside the cell. But you know what? It's still advantageous for the cell to take up even more glucose. But will glucose go from outside to inside passively? Because what's the concentration? Low outside, high inside. Glucose can't get inside the cell passively. So you know what? There are special transporters in the membrane that can take glucose and make it go from low concentration to high concentration. But in so doing, what is necessary? There's another necessary step that has to happen here. Glucose won't automatically go from low to high. It can. It's allowed, but something else has to happen here. Energy. You need energy, right? That's on the slide. And what's that energy? ATP has got to be converted into ADP plus inorganic phosphate, and then glucose can go from low concentration to high to make sure that this cell has all the glucose that it needs to stay alive, to make ATP. So that's what we call molecular transport. You still need some kind of protein molecule embedded in the cell membrane for that to happen. There's got to be a membrane that can hydrolyze ATP and then shove glucose up its concentration gradient. That's molecular transport. There's a couple of other kinds of transports. We call particle or macromolecular transport. And this is the forming of a vesicle around some kind of particle that will be ingested by the cell. So let me see what kind of figures I got for that. That's that nice cell membrane right here. Okay. So here is a diagram. Let's just zoom into this one right here. Okay, so here is a cell membrane, and what's how would you characterize the basic nature of this cell membrane right here? It's a barrier, but what kind of molecules make that membrane up? Phospholipid, right? There's a phosphate part and there's a lipid part, and the phosphate part I actually drew out. That's that phosphate with all the oxygen molecules around it. That forms, okay, this little ball on the outside right here. But how many layers are there? There's two. So a really nice way of talking about a membrane is what? It's a phospholipid bilayer. That's the simplest way that you can appreciate a membrane. It's a little bit more complicated because things can dissolve in the membrane like these different proteins. All right, so here is an example where we have the cell membrane. So we see the outside of the cell here, or what we call the extracellular fluid, and this is the cytoplasm or intracellular fluid, right? And don't forget cytoplasm is what? Organelles plus cytosol, the liquid part of a cell. So textbooks are slowly catching up to all of that. So here we have a particle, maybe a bacteria or other kind of particle. Maybe this is a glucose molecule, for instance, something that your cell wants to have inside the cytoplasm. So the cell membrane can push out and surround this particle, and then eventually this little passageway right here is completely going to close off, and this vesicle then can be incorporated as an organelle inside the cell. And since this is a particle right here, we would call that phagocytosis. So that would be a way of importing material from the extracellular fluid to the intracellular fluid. So that would be example, if it's a particle, phagocytosis, that just means cell eating, for instance. So any kind of particulate matter, and it can actually be large, right, like a virus or a bacteria or some large protein, can be taken up by a cell. If, for instance, the cell was going to take up extracellular fluid without having any particles in it, that's what we would call pinocytosis, or cell drinking. So we could have smaller solutes in there, salts and things of that nature being ingested by the cell. So anything that goes from outside the cell to inside the cell, we call that endocytosis. Endocytosis. So how many different ways that you know now that endocytosis can take place? What are two ways endocytosis takes place? Phagocytosis for particles, pinocytosis, or you can say pinocytosis for fluids, cell drinking. All right, but the cell might have things that it wants to excrete from itself or secrete from itself. So vesicles will go the reverse direction. All right, so here, let's take a look at okay, what do we have right here? Here we have a vesicle that's inside the cell, and we have some kind of product, some secretory molecules that the cell wants to put into the extracellular fluid. This vesicle can fuse to the plasma membrane. Look at that plasma membrane. How would you describe that internal structure? It's just a phospholipid bilayer. Right, and the vesicle itself is a phospholipid bilayer, so all membranes are very, very similar. So the vesicle will dock and fuse to the cell membrane, and then the vesicle will open up to the extracellular fluid, so whatever contents were inside the vesicle now can move out into the extracellular fluid. And what do you call this process? Okay, exocytosis, and exocytosis in this particular case happens just by diffusion, because we have high concentration of molecules here, low in this region, so things will just want to move. But this process of exocytosis is what we call an active process, because moving these vesicles around, making them dock, and moving them, having these membranes join, right, that's an active process. That requires ATP. So that's why we call this an active process. So exocytosis due to secretion because of these secretory vesicles, that is an active process. Okay. All right, so phagocytosis, pinocytosis are just subclasses of endocytosis, and exocytosis doesn't matter what we call it, whether it's a particle or a fluid. Okay. Well, let's just look a little bit at protein synthesis. And a protein is one kind of important biomolecule that's in your body of four important kinds. Proteins are one All right, let me erase the board right here. So proteins are one important kind of molecule that your body needs. Carbohydrates are another. And lipids are another. And nucleic acids are another. And nucleic acids are things that make, for instance, DNA and even RNA. So we're going to talk about how your body makes proteins. So you have to know that a protein has a basic building block. And maybe you know what that is before you even took this class. What's a basic building block of a protein? That is amino acid. So proteins are made from amino acids. And when you think of a protein, you should think of a chain. So what's the basic building block of a chain? A link, right? So an amino acid really is a link in a chain. A protein is just a nice long filamentous strand. It's like a thread, but it's not made of smaller thread. It's made of links. And the link in a protein is an amino acid. So it's one amino acid joined to another, to another, to another. So it's a sequence of amino acids. It's just a long sequence of amino acids. Okay. So I want to tell you about what we call the central dogma in biology, and that is a protein is made according to some specific orders or specific information. And that information on how to build you is contained where? In your cells. In DNA, right? In the nucleus, in chromosomes. So that information is in chromosomes. And that information has to be used to make proteins. Okay. And the way that that information flows between a couple of these different kinds of molecules is that information always flows from DNA. And DNA is found in what organelle? In the nucleus only. Otherwise, it can be damaged. But that information is converted into RNA. That's another kind of nucleotide. That RNA can go into the cytoplasm. And we said last time, who cares if that RNA gets damaged? Because why? Because the original copy is still here in DNA, safe inside the nucleus. So the information in RNA in the cytoplasm is used to make protein. So information always flows in this direction, from DNA to RNA to protein, and never the reverse direction. Protein cannot tell in your cells how to make RNA or to incorporate that information. The sequence of amino acids in a protein can't determine anything about RNA, and that RNA can't be converted into DNA. So it's a one-way street. And why is that a really good thing? Why is it that proteins can't make DNA inside your nucleus? Why is that a really good reason? I'm sorry? Okay. Well, because tonight, when you go home and have a chicken dinner, you don't have to worry about waking up with feathers or a beak in the morning, right? Because you're eating all that protein that can't influence who you are, right? Because it's just protein. Can't be converted into DNA that ends up inside your nucleus. That's kind of a really simple, kind of a silly example, but that's one of the really good reasons.
No metamorphosis.
No metamorphosis that way. Or reverse metamorphosis. So who you are is determined by your DNA, and that then is related into what kind of proteins are made, not the reverse of that. Okay. All right, so protein synthesis is a two-step process. And these two steps are what we call transcription and translation. So these terms, if you look them up in the dictionary, it will help you understand why we call them what we call them. Right, and when I was studying, I just memorized, and I had a 50-50 chance of getting them right. Right, so hopefully you'll have a good understanding of these. So transcription is when DNA, or the information in DNA, is converted into information in RNA. That is what we call transcription. Okay, and where does this process take place? Where does transcription take place? In the nucleus. And why is it in the nucleus? Because that's where you find DNA. That's where you keep DNA, so it doesn't get damaged, right? So that process has to be inside the nucleus. Otherwise, the DNA would be damaged if it's in the cytoplasm, and that cell would die. Okay. So there are three kinds of RNA. There's something called messenger RNA, mRNA. This determines the sequence of amino acids in a protein. There is something called transfer RNA. Transfer RNA carries amino acids around in the cytoplasm, because when you build a chain link by link, you got to get a link from someplace to make a chain. And when you make a protein, you got to get an amino acid from someplace to make a big long chain of amino acids. It's that transfer RNA that goes and finds an amino acid and brings it over to the protein as it's being made. So you could think of a tRNA as being like a taxi RNA.
It's just like building the blocks.
It's just building blocks together, and what brings those blocks to being put together is the tRNA. And then the third kind of RNA is what we call ribosomal RNA, and that's the RNA that makes up the actual ribosome. And you had to learn what the function of a ribosome is. What's the function of a ribosome? That's where protein synthesis takes place in the cytoplasm. It's that little tiny dot, that little tiny sphere is where proteins can be made. So ribosomal RNA is really what you should think of as the workbench. That's where the protein is being made. And if endoplasmic reticulum has that little workbench, what do we call it? What do we call endoplasmic reticulum that has that little tiny workbench on it that can make a protein? That's called rough endoplasmic reticulum, because it looks like sandpaper. Those little workbenches look, make the ER look rough, right? Okay. All right, so those are the three kinds of RNA. And that RNA, of course, can leave the nucleus. Now, why do we call that transcription? Okay. Right under here, in nucleic acids, your body has, well, for instance, proteins. How many different kinds of amino acids are there? I can't remember. There's about 20 or so. So there are about 20 different kinds. In the alphabet, English alphabet, how many letters are there? 26, right? So think of like different letters of an alphabet for protein and amino acids. So there are different parts, there are different components of amino acids that can be used to make a protein. How many different kinds of nucleic acids are there? There are two kinds. There's two kinds, and they're very similar to each other. There's DNA, and there's RNA. And the basic building block of DNA, just like amino acid is the building block of a protein, the building block of DNA is what we call a nucleotide. And guess what the basic building block of RNA is? Okay, protein is amino acid, carbohydrate is a monosaccharide. The building block of DNA is a nucleotide. The building block of RNA is nucleotide. It's the same thing. The building blocks are almost identical. There's a little variation. It's very slight. Maybe one of these days I'll show you what the difference is. Okay? But the building block is the same for DNA and RNA. So in terms of the language, what's the language of DNA? Nucleotides. What's the language of RNA? Nucleotides. It's the same language. All right, so DNA and RNA speak the same language. So when you have a document, for instance, and you want to get an exact duplicate of it, what do we call that? That's a transcript. So for instance, if you're going to apply to another college someplace and they want to see your record at Cypress College or a different college or high school or whatever, what do they ask for? A transcript, right? So a transcript really is it's basically a photocopy of that information, all right? But what's in admissions and records would be like the DNA. That's a thing that never gets lost. But what you send out is the transcript that would be, for instance, RNA. Yeah. Yeah, there is a difference. Not all of the nucleotides are exactly the same, and they're modified a little bit. I don't know if I'm going to get into that, okay? But that's probably pretty, that is a little important. But still, they're all just nucleotides. So what I want you to see is that it's the same language, and transcription just makes an additional copy. But if it was 1,000 years ago, well, say 2,000 years ago, if you wanted a transcript of your records at a college, what would you have to do? You'd have to buy a little candle, right, and get some feather out of some poor bird and a little inkwell and do what? Just hand copy everything, right? Too fast. So a transcript is exactly the same thing. That's why we call that transcription. Okay, translation, all right, is copying information from RNA to a protein. Now, what about this? Why do we call that translation? What's the language of proteins? What's the language of RNA? Are they the same? They're different. So what do you call that process of going from one language to another? That's translation, right? So so when they name these things, it actually makes sense if you think about it, right? It seems really complicated, but it's not too bad. So translation would be like going from Farsi to what? Yeah, Spanish, right? Same thing for RNA going to protein. Now, where does this take place? Does not happen in the nucleus. Cytoplasm, what's the organelle that you need? You need the ribosome in order for that to happen. So ribosomes are important organelle necessary for translation in the cytoplasm. That's the organelle. And that organelle can be a free ribosome in the cytosol floating around, or it can be attached to endoplasmic reticulum, thus the rough ER. Okay, so the linear sequence of nucleotides in that messenger RNA determines the linear sequence of amino acids, which makes up a protein. Okay, so on a test, I would want you to know good definitions for transcription and translation, where they take place, and how information is being converted one way or the other. All right, so that's I don't think that should be too bad. You might have some pretty nice diagrams in your book. Here is a ribosome, for instance. Let's see if I can show you what's happening here. Here is a nice membrane. So if we have a ribosome attached to this membrane, what can you tell me about, I guess that kind of looks like blue. What is this blue thing right here? What kind of organelle is this blue membrane? Ah, it says right there. Endoplasmic reticulum. But if it's got a ribosome on it, what would be a better name? Rough ER. Right, and so here we have a ribosome attached to the endoplasmic reticulum. You see a couple different subunits for it. And the messenger RNA goes right through a little tunnel of this ribosome. Transfer RNAs are bringing over amino acids. So each one of these little balls right here represents one amino acid and a protein that's being made. So the instructions in messenger RNA instruct this ribosome what amino acid needs to be placed next to its neighbor, right? These amino acids, how do amino acids find their way to the ribosome? What brings them over to the ribosome? That transfer RNA. So this picture is pretty good because it shows you rRNA that makes the ribosome. It shows you the messenger RNA, that's the instruction for putting amino acids in the correct position. But I guess I don't see a taxi RNA, a tRNA, but we know it's there because it's taking individual little balls from all over the cytoplasm, bringing them to this ribosome to make that protein. And if it's rough ER, that protein automatically gets placed inside the endoplasmic reticulum. We call that the cisterna, the center part, and this protein that's right here is now destined, has a certain kind of fate associated with it. We like to talk about fate of different chemicals in the body. What's the fate of this protein that's made? It's inside the ER. The fate of this protein is going to be different than the fate of a protein made by a ribosome that's free in the cytoplasm. Because this protein is inside what? It's inside a membrane. It's inside the endoplasmic reticulum. And you can see it migrating into this vesicle right here. And that vesicle can fuse with a Golgi body for modification, okay, and packaging. And after it leaves the Golgi body, it can go outside the cell for secretion. So proteins that are made by ribosomes on endoplasmic reticulum, or the fate of these proteins here, is for secretion, or they're going to always be inside a vesicle inside the cell, like for a lysosome inside the cell. So if this protein is going to be inside a lysosome, what would you call that protein? It's an enzyme. What's the name of the enzyme inside lysosomes? Lysozyme. So a name of this thing here would be lysozyme. Okay. Oh, so anything made by rough ER is either going to, the fate is going to be always be inside a vesicle or for secretion. But proteins made by free ribosomes are just released to the cytosol. They're just going to dissolve in the cytosol and perform their function inside the cell, not for secretion. Okay. There's something else I wanted to say, but I can't remember what it was. Might come back to me. So make sure that you have some kind of facility with transcription, translation, why it's broken down into two parts. Okay, the building blocks, yeah. If it's made by rough ER, that protein is, the fate of that protein is for secretion, or it's always going to be inside a vesicle inside the cell because it's trapped in that membrane. It's packaged in that membrane. And the free ribosome just makes proteins that can diffuse around inside the cell any place in the cytosol and perform their function. Okay. Cell division. Let's talk about cell division. And this is the last topic that we have to talk about in this particular chapter. Okay, so let's talk about why do cells divide in your body? There's two important reasons, and I want to make sure that we're all just really clear on the reasons for mitosis or cell division. To repair. Yeah, for instance, that's a really important reason. For instance, if you have a cell that gets damaged, or if you cut yourself and you destroy some of those cells, you would like to repair that damage, right? So one reason for mitosis is to replace old and damaged cells, and repair is an important process in that. So replace, do I have that on slide? Oh, it's not on the slide. Let's write it on the board. So we're talking mitosis. We're just going to talk about the big concepts first. Mitosis is to do what? Replace. Number one, replace old or damaged cells. Because as cells get older, sometimes they just lose their function. And of course, you want cells functioning inside your body. That's one reason. And what's another reason? Growth. Growth is a good one. So let's write this down. Growth. Okay. So at one point in time, you were just a single cell. We call that a zygote. And being a zygote is really not that much fun because you can't sit in anatomy class, take notes, or listen to anything, music or nothing if you're just a single cell. So you got to have what? Trillions of cells before you're a human. And that process that produces all those trillions of cells is mitosis. So it allows you growth, right, to grow up. What parts of your body always keep growing? Yeah, that's what you're, did we talk about that already? Ears and nose are always growing. Not real fast, but.
Strength. If you give the body strength, I mean, the more cells you have.
The more cells you have makes you stronger, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, tissues.
Mitosis. I don't know if I would call that an important function for mitosis, but growth, which might produce strength.
Okay.
But if you lose cells, for instance, muscle cells or something, you're going to be weaker. You'll employ mitosis maybe to regain some of that function. Okay. So the common denominator maybe would be more growth or to replace old and damaged cells. And I mention this because a lot of times I ask what the function of mitosis is, and people say reproduction, okay, because it's reproducing cells. But actually, reproduction and mitosis almost mean the same thing. So it's using the one definition to explain another one. It really means the same thing, so it's not a very good definition. So it's not really reproduction. It's what? Replace old and damaged cells and for growth. And mitosis is reproduction. But what kind of reproduction is it? Okay, it's cellular reproduction. All right, it's important. It's not the most interesting form of reproduction, but if we have one cell, it's going to separate into two cells. right? And this cell right here we call a parent cell. And these cells over here are what we call daughter cells. And this parent cell, like most of the cells in your body, does anybody know how many chromosomes you have in a human body? You've got 46, but it's a special arrangement of 46. You actually have, you have a number of different sets. How many different sets do you have? You have two different sets. Why do you have two different sets? Because you got one mom and one dad. Okay? Even if you were a test tube baby, you still had a mom and dad somewhere in there. You still had two different people. All right, so you have, I would ask who's a test tube baby in here. I don't know if anybody knows if they are. It doesn't matter, right? So it's just sort of interesting. Well, you have two sets of chromosomes, right? Number one and number two all the way down to number 23. And then the same over here, number one and number two all the way down to number 23. And this one set we call M because you got that from your mom. And this other set over here we say P because this is the, oh, well, I'm sorry. M is the maternal and P is the paternal set, right? And when you go through mitosis right here, guess what you end up with? The exact same thing. Nothing is special. So this cell right here you could think of as what compared to this one? Sort of in a science fiction kind of way, a clone. Right, so daughter cells, and the same for this daughter cell right here. Two sets, exactly identical. So what's the difference between this daughter cell and this daughter cell? Nothing. What's the difference between this daughter cell and the parent cell? Nothing. Right, so that's what we call mitosis, when you just get more cells, but you don't change the chromosomes one way or the other. So all these cells are identical. That's reproduction, but what kind of reproduction is that? That produces the same things over and over again. That's what we call asexual reproduction, right? So mitosis is asexual reproduction, produces the same thing over and over again. And so that's why you can't say mitosis is reproduction. That's like saying, well, define Joel, like my name. You could say, well, it's Joe. Well, that doesn't tell you much, right? It's just the same, different names for the same thing. Mitosis and reproduction are the same thing. So what are the reasons for mitosis? Replace old and damaged cells, and for growth. Okay. So let's look at some things about the cell cycle of which mitosis is a part of. All right, so you can probably fill this in just a little bit. All right, so the cell cycle is a five-step process, and we can... And these steps are what we call interphase, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. And you have to know something about each of these different phases right here, and of course the correct order, because metaphase never follows anaphase. Right? What always follows metaphase is anaphase. So you got to know the right order of these terms. And so we can make a little acronym of the first letter of each one of these phases and make a word out of it, and that little word is IPMAT, which maybe doesn't make a whole lot of sense to anybody, all right? But sort of recently, it sort of does, because now what's in common use is HAZMAT. What does HAZMAT mean? Hazardous materials. These are specially trained people that know how to clean up spills like on a freeway or something without getting hurt, right? So that's a pretty sophisticated group of people. So HAZMAT, IPMAT. So just remember IPMAT, this I stands for interphase. What's the next phase? Prophase. So you still have to know how to spell these things out. And that could even be on the practicum that you guys have next week. Okay. And there's another term called cytokinesis. And cytokinesis, at least for me in lecture, you have to talk to your lab instructor, depending if they're going to ask you a question about cytokinesis. But in lecture, just know that cytokinesis happens in this last phase of mitosis called telophase. And some cells, it maybe begins in anaphase, and probably for the next 100 years, scientists will be talking about each other. Well, cytokinesis, happens here and not here and here and here and here. But for this class, where does cytokinesis happen? Yeah, telophase. Now, what is cytokinesis? Okay. Mitosis is the separation of these chromosomes, and cytokinesis is the separation of all the other organelles in cytoplasm and the pinching of two cells into two separate cells, or the pinching of the parent cell into two different daughter cells, and these daughter cells should have about the same kinds of organelles as well as their chromosomes. So cytokinesis is the pinching apart of the two cells. And what phase does that happen in? Telophase. Okay. So your book has got some really good pictures of mitosis. All right, and here we have mitosis. We can look at some illustrations right here, as well as some of these fancy stains. Okay, so if I look at this cell right here, and if I look at this cell right here, can you see that? Does that help? Maybe like that's a little bit better. Okay, so here is the nucleus. You can see the nuclear envelope. Here is the nucleus. Here's probably the cell membrane over here. Yeah? Really hard for me to see. Okay, so here's the nucleus, and if we look at the nucleus right here, I can see filaments, but can you see anything that really looks like a chromosome right there? I don't see any chromosomes. So what kind of chromatin is in this nucleus right here? Is it extended or condensed? It's extended. So it's being what? Used, right? It's being, as a matter of fact, what do we call that process when DNA is being used? What's it making? RNA. What's that process called? Transcription. Right, so you should be aware of those words and be able to use them. So this extended chromatin, we don't see any chromosomes right here. So this would be a good example of interphase, where the DNA is being used to make more organelles and it's being replicated. Yeah. Where does it say condensed? Condensed chromatin. I don't know why it says that. It says both. Well, in all the DNA inside your cells, well, I think that's a really good question because it must be confusing if I say one thing and the picture is labeled another, right? Okay. I don't know how many genes make up what we call the genome inside a cell. Let's just say 50,000 genes are contained within the DNA of your cells. But guess what? You're not using all 50,000 of those genes at one time. You might be using only 100 or a couple hundred genes. So guess which ones are unpackaged to be used? Just those 200 or 1,000 genes, not all 50,000. So during interphase, whatever genes are not being used, they're stored in a protected form, which is condensed. All right? So only the genes that are being used are extended, pulled off of a chromosome. So maybe you can see some chromatin that looks darker or something over here that's packaged with histones. But if it's extended, it's being used. Yeah? I would have to say extended chromatin, but probably I would give you a multiple choice question and ask you something more of the function of extended versus condensed chromatin. So chromatin that's actively being used for transcription is extended, and chromatin that's being packaged so that it's safe, then that is condensed. Okay. So that's why I think we have that confusion right there. So during interphase, we'll maybe have both. But in this particular case, right over here, what kind of chromatin is this? This is when all the DNA is protected, that is condensed. Hopefully you don't see extended chromatin on this diagram. You won't anywhere over here. Okay. All right, so what's the first phase of mitosis? Okay. The first phase of active cell division is prophase. Okay, so interphase is not really mitosis. I include it because it's part of the cell cycle, but mitosis is what we call a growth phase. That's where organelles are being duplicated, which is what we call replication. Chromosomes are being replicated. All right, so if after mitosis you have the same number of chromosomes in each one of these cells, what do you have to do with this parent cell first? You've got to duplicate these chromosomes, so when you split them up, they each have the same number. That process we call replication, and that replication happens during interphase. So interphase is a growth phase for replication. Okay. So prophase is really the first phase of mitosis. And what happens is that chromosomes start to condense. They're getting packaged. Because what happens is that the nuclear envelope is going to disappear and the DNA could be damaged. So it's going to be condensed. And now you should be able to see some chromosomes inside the nucleus, right? So those are some important parts about prophase. Chromosomes are condensed and the nuclear envelope disappears. There's another thing, the spindle apparatus, which is composed of microtubules and the centrioles, all right, start to form, and actually the centrioles start to split apart, go to either side or either pole of the nucleus. So the spindle apparatus. So you can see here is one centriole, here's the other with microtubules connecting from one centriole to the other. And these are used to grab hold of the chromosomes, and they grab hold of the chromosomes right pretty much in the middle. We call that the kinetochore. And the microtubules then start to move the chromosomes around inside the cell because now they're connected to those little monorail systems. So those are some things about prophase. And in my lecture, I won't ask you the difference between early prophase and late prophase. All right, so during prophase, what happens? Chromatin condenses, its chromosomes form. The nuclear envelope disappears, and the chromosomes attach to the spindle apparatus. That's what happens during prophase. And you can see this on the actual micrographs right here as well. All right, what's the next phase? What's after prophase? Metaphase. Metaphase is the easiest phase to see. And during metaphase, right, the microtubules of the spindle apparatus have moved all the chromosomes so that they are on the equator of the cell. They're all lined up. And that's really easy to see. Here you can see all the chromosomes lined up in the middle of the cell. Metaphase. Guess what meta means?
Middle,
right? So it just means right in the middle. I don't know what else to say about metaphase. Okay, and now anaphase. Hope I should have asked you guys. Okay. Anaphase. Now the chromosomes start to separate. Here you see, well, let's go back to metaphase right here. Maybe I should have said something. So here you see a chromosome, but what's the best way to understand the structure of this chromosome right here? It is really two identical chromosomes attached, right, at this point right here we call a centromere. We have a chromosome that's been replicated. So now you have two chromosomes that are attached. They're really just identical. They're attached, so we consider that one chromosome. The chromosomes during metaphase line up. And during anaphase, right here, those two chromosomes that are identical split apart. Okay. Back in metaphase right here, we talk about these two different strands of DNA as being sister chromatids. So here is one chromatid, here's the other. They're identical chromosomes that are attached to each other. They're called sister chromatids. So the best way to talk about anaphase is that during anaphase, the sister chromatids are separated, and once they're separated, they're called daughter chromatids. Okay, so the daughter chromosomes start to separate, they're being pulled apart. And then the last phase, these daughter chromosomes are pulled all the way over to the centriole. Oops. And the cells start to split apart. So this thing right here is what we call a cleavage furrow. It's a depression in the cell membrane right along the equator. And the organelles, right, and the chromosomes then are separated into two different cells. And so this process of separating the organelles and cytosol into two separate cells is what we call cytokinesis. That happens during telophase. All right, so this cleavage furrow is a necessary part or a requisite part of cytokinesis. And the other thing that happens during telophase is that the nuclear membrane starts to form once again around the chromosomes, because we want to protect their chromosomes, because soon what's going to happen? That chromatin is going to become extended and it's going to be used for protein synthesis, right? Okay, and then the cell can go into another growth phase during interphase. All right, I think I said pretty much everything. All right, so for next time, I'll activate, we'll do your next homework, pre-lecture reading assignment. I'm not going to activate the answer key yet for that until after next lecture, but look at all of the organelles and make sure you can identify them individually in your book. And also tell me what the function is, and also be able to identify all the phases of mitosis just by looking at them, and tell me maybe one or two significant steps that's happening at each one of those phases. Okay.